Hello, I'm Andy Burnham. Welcome to Sparks. This week we look at Soundbase 3D, the latest surround sound gimmickry, in use at Kiss FM in London and in many Hollywood films to enhance Dolby Stereo. But does it work? There's an interview with Alan Howard, a sound effects specialist who used Soundbase 3D on the latest Star Trek film. A review of Secret Signals, the Euro Number Mystery, a new book investigating the number stations. The high street banks are looking seriously at smart cards to cut down on card fraud. The technology of putting a computer on a card. The outcome of the World Administrative Radio Conference. NASA's new search for extraterrestrial intelligence. How BBC Radio is shaping up to face the competition. World service in the air, and new Russian radio stations from jamming sites, and a new sampling technique that can accurately synthesize a grand piano. Finally, researchers make ICs out of yeast. Or have they just been spending too much time in the pub at lunchtimes? Well, we'll find out in Sparks this week from Radio Facts.
short item here from Asia Pacific Broadcasting about reception of BBC World Service on board airliners. BBC World Service Radio has signed an agreement with Cathay Pacific to provide its 24-hour-a-day World Service coverage on the airline's flights. Cathay Pacific's fleet of Boeing 747 jets is being fitted with equipment to pick up the service on short or medium wavelengths. Besides an antenna, the equipment comprises a small receiver that is programmed to think for itself. The antenna can tune and retune automatically throughout the flight to the appropriate BBC transmitters and relay stations. The service is due to start later this year. That was in Asia Pacific Broadcasting.
And from Audio Media magazine, Mel Lambert talks to the man who continues to boldly go where no sound effects designer has gone before, Alan Howarth. In the highly competitive world of big budget movies, the way that a feature film sounds is now considered to be as important as the way it looks. To ensure that the Dolby Stereo soundtrack does its job in a movie house, film directors are turning to professionals like Alan Howarth, whose sound designing skills have appeared on all 6 Star Trek films, plus Raiders of the Lost Ark, Gremlins, Poltergeist, The Hunt for Red October, Total Recall, and The Little Mermaid. So, how did you first become involved with a specific sound design project? Your reputation obviously opens a number of doors, but how does that initial contact come about? Predominantly, the initial contact is through either the picture editor or the sound editors. For a long time, I've functioned as an accessory to the editorial group. A supervising sound effects editor is dealing with the Foley production dialogue, library sound effects and ADR, and getting the various elements all to the dubbing stage. I've been called in as a specialist to create what we might call hyper-real sounds, material that's not available in a library, or which you can't go out with a microphone and record for yourself, such as spaceships or voices from beyond or monsters, that kind of thing. You recently finished working on the 6th Star Trek movie. Did you use any of the same sound signatures you developed for the earlier Star Trek movies? Yes, I've worked on all 6 movies, and even with the new technical capabilities, I've reused previously created sounds. But now I can layer them with additional dynamic sweetening. While we wouldn't depart from the sound of the Enterprise, for example, there are new enhancements and natural sweeteners I can use, things that don't detract from the established sounds of transporters, spaceships, doors, and so on, but which give them new impact, new power, and new speed. As a consequence of my close involvement with sound design for the Star Trek series, I spent last summer preparing a new CD for Crescendo Records, compiling all my Star Trek effects. I've collected 10 years worth of sounds and sampled them all into a synclavier. A lot of my original quarter-inch tapes weren't stored properly, and I had problems with oxide build-up on the guides. I would take a little area of the sound effect I needed, play the tape once, sample it into the synclavier, and then put it all away. Those sounds, which were relatively unplayable, are now stored on a worm, write once, read many optical drive, with 100-year shelf life. The Star Trek producer's philosophy was, why reinvent the wheel if we've already got an acceptable one? For example, during Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, we saw the Excelsior at the end of the film for maybe 4 minutes or less, and the exterior for a mere 30 seconds. But I knew back then that I was establishing a new ship, so I developed a full complement of sounds for the Excelsior, rather than just a little snippet. Now for Star Trek VI, the Excelsior is back, and I've already created an established bank of sounds. Do you monitor the stereo pairs through the 4:2:4 surround sound matrix to see if the Dolby stereo process will collapse them to mono or possibly upset the stereo separation? I've learned enough through experience, Alan Howarth says, using a phase correlation meter. I've also used the base, which is Bedini Audio Space Environment Unit, to counter the collapse to mono sometimes produced by the Dolby system. The sound base unit, manufactured by Gamma Electronic Systems, examines a two-channel input and strips away the mono information. That's anything that's common to left and right. It then performs an expansion of the stereo sound field. The phase meter sees the result as having zero left-to-right correlation. You can then back into the center image the extracted mono information. Now you have discrete left-center-right information nested in base-encoded two-channel elements. The Dolby stereo matrix sees the processed result and loves it. Let's return to your conceptualizing what sound might be needed on a project. Imagine the sound editors viewing a rough cut of a movie or video production. They're saying to themselves, we need something here. We need something Alan Howarth's good at doing. What kind of things would you consider you to be good at doing? There are a couple of decisions to be made. First, is this science fiction or a horror movie, a fantasy piece? In other words, we need sounds that don't exist in reality. The second decision would be, is there a lot of optical work for scenes that are being generated entirely in the camera or using computer-generated graphics? And a good example would be a new medieval show I'm doing called Army of Darkness. It's shot on Intravision, basically actors against a blue screen with projected backgrounds. So there's no production sound whatsoever. There's lots of magic and ghosts. I'm a perfect candidate for that show because I can deal with horses and arrows, but I can make them bigger horses, more scary catapults, and legions of skeletons. I worked on the soundtrack of The Little Mermaid, and I discovered one interesting side effect of sound-based processing. If I sample a processed sample on speed into the synclavier, and then alter the sample rate for the retuning, the space changes. Now bass processing on speed creates a bunch of other versions off speed. While working on The Little Mermaid for Disney, I made swirling chords of bass processed wind and water effects. Everything is scaled out real nice so that octaves and fifths line up. Let's talk about other examples of your sound design magic. During work on the latest Star Trek VI, for example, you were asked to develop specific sounds for the trial scene. What was your brief? Yes, the Klingon staffs. The scene. Kirk is on trial in a Klingon environment. He and Bones are the only two Federation members. Everyone else in this huge arena court is a Klingon. Kirk is coming up on this elevator into the center of a huge arena, and we want to hear 50,000 Klingons shouting, "Kirk! Kirk! Kirk!" and beating their staffs on the ground. The director wanted it to sound like the audience was in Dodger Stadium, so the first effect I created was the staff hit. We didn't know what the rhythm was, so I had to do 50,000 individual staffs hitting the floor. Just enough slamming so there appeared to be a lot of them, but not so messy that it was non-rhythmic. We figured later that we'd cut this to the ADR or whatever the pictures were doing. I had worked on a movie a long time ago called Behold Hawaii, which had Hawaiian dancers hitting their staffs on a wooden stage. Mark Magini had recorded nice clean staff hits from beneath the stage. I loaded 8 or 10 of them into the synclavier and stretched them plus and minus maybe a musical fourth. Now I could slam down on the keyboard and have what was originally 10 staff hits generate 100 staff hits from one wail on the keyboard. Then using the sequencer, I can continually go back and play against myself until I got what I'll call 500 staff hits. Now I can play that sequence back into the synclavier and resample it so that every time one key goes down, I've got 500 staffs. I can also move them apart in pitch and then add reverb. Now I've got 32 stereo voices in this piece. Wham! 50,000 staff hits. So I gave the sound editors the finished tapes, and I didn't hear from them for a long time. Then I got a call a few weeks later, while I'm in the middle of the Michael Jackson black and white video, from the Star Trek editors. "Alan, this is George Walters II calling. Remember those staff hits? They don't like the Kirk they recorded." Apparently about 25 guys had been brought into the studio as Klingons, going, "Kirk, Kirk, Kirk," so George said. They don't like the Kirks. So, therefore, the staff hits don't work. What can you do with the Kirks? They sent over some tapes with all these readings of Kirk, which I sampled into the Synclavier. Now, here was the trick. The sound editors wanted the Kirks to slowly speed up, to build excitement. But the director, Nicholas Meyer, wanted it to stay on a steady speed. Now you're caught between what he wants and what you know we've got to do. Simultaneously, the scene had been scored. They wanted the Kirks to be on the beat. So I get a copy of the music, and now I'm a musician playing 50,000 King Klingons going Kirk in time with the music. During a slow accelerando against the music and finding the right cracks and the right holes, so it goes from half notes to triplets to duplets to quarter notes. Now I've built a homogeneous scene of Kirks going against the music. The end result sounds like we've gone out and gotten a large men's choir to sing chorus against the score. It worked wonderfully. Is there anything on Star Trek, Red October, or the many other films you've worked on where you felt you achieved something that was unique? Well, each of the projects had their own signature. The hunt for Red October was a wonderful challenge because of the underwater sounds and creating this lumbering submarine image. One of the things I learnt in Red October, which I've now translated into the last Star Trek, was to create a sense of size. Red October was a long submarine. We created different sounds for the nose, the mid-cabin, the engine compartment, and the propeller. So you heard them in sequence, changing slightly as it passes, to give a heightened sense of size. For Star Trek, there's now a different sound for the approaching nose of the spaceship, a sort of bow wash, and another for mid-motor, then the engine bigness, followed by something for the afterburn of the exhaust. So each turn beat the next. And I've seen Hunt for Red October, and it's notable in the Dolby Stereo as when the submarine comes towards you, it really sounds like it's going straight over your head due to the effects of the four-channel sound. It's very impressive. There was a discussion right at the outset of the Star Trek series, is there sound in space? Well, no, there isn't. But without the effects, the flybys would be really boring. So as far as we're concerned, there is sound in space. I even developed a space ambience, the sound of the void of space. It's actually my old spring reverbs, recorded off-speed into a Tiak 8-track, which would run at 60 inches a second. When played back at 3 3/4, the sound became super elongated. That became an established sound which has been in every Star Trek movie. Star Trek has been a great learning experience. I started much like a sound design apprentice, then developed my bachelor's degree to my master's, and now to my doctorate. It's been a great experience. Well, that's part of an interview in Audio Media with Alan Howarth. So, this Soundbase 3D thing that you heard mentioned there, well, what's it all about? Let's hear a bit of the advert. Bass processing can be applied to any signal path to bring stereo source material into the dimensional or binaural domain. Processing real-time from mixing console or amp rack creates out-of-speaker audio effects from any mix, with sounds which appear to come on from all corners of the room. Using the unit actually enhances bass positioning, extending the phase-coherent response of low frequencies, bringing them forward to the centre of the mix. Other advantages of the system include high-definition stereo balance to positions wide of the stereo axis, with compensation of biasing at the critical D binaural delay rate, to bring true stereo to virtually the whole of the theatre or auditorium environment. That's according to the advert for Soundbase, and another article which features it. Cheap tricks reach first base. Mono incompatibility hindered the progress of 3D stereo sound broadcasting until 3D bass came along. Christine Morgan reports. This is in International Broadcasting. Three-dimensional sound has come out of the laboratory and is for the first time playing a part in a scheduled radio service. Last December, the London dance music radio station Kiss FM started round-the-clock 3D sound transmission. The radio authority in Britain said Kiss is the only station in the world to be broadcasting 3D sound regularly. The Bedini Audio Spatial Environment, the bass system invented by engineer John Bedini, is a 3D sound system made by Gamma Electronics in California. Soundbass, a small West London company which made its debut at the Plaza Light and Sound show in 1990, upgrades bass technology under license from its United States relative to suit European specifications at a price of around £2,800. The company, which includes former founder members Paul McCallum and Glenn Hall, is on a mission to bring 3D sound, or psychoacoustic ambience, to the masses via a number of routes: radio and television broadcasting, live concerts and events, plus retail recordings on vinyl, tape and compact disc. Prior to testing bass, KISS engineer Andy Howard didn't believe the system would cut the mustard. Being a sceptical engineer, I thought that people listening on their domestic trannies wouldn't be able to hear the difference, he admitted. But that's definitely not the case, and we've got lots of people ringing up and asking about it. Howard also claimed that even the worst stereo systems, particularly car stereos, sound better with the addition of bass. Bass lends itself to give added dimension to closely mixed stereo, for instance TV and radio, where mono compatibility is a critical factor, explained Soundbass's Hall. It adds a degree of binaural crosstalk to the mix, about 3 dB, which when mixed down to mono, the overall balance remains consistent with conventional stereo. The technology is all within the analog domain. Details of the actual circuit topology are a closely guarded secret, but the principle of the design involves binaural crosstalk cancellation at the critical binaural reference time of 0.431 milliseconds, which is the time it takes for the left and right ear to assimilate the stereo signal to give values for direction and distance, based on the Haas effect, analogous to binocular vision. In very simple terms, Haas described how a short delay in amplified sound can alter the brain's perception of where that sound is coming from. The bass system, just using two loudspeakers, tricks the brain into thinking that sound is coming from all directions. In terms of hardware, bass is just a standard 19-inch rack mount black box, but it can produce effects such as sound swirling around your head. And unlike traditional stereo, it doesn't matter where you are in relation to the speakers. The bass audio effect can be added to recordings at the mix stage or for broadcasting at the transmission stage. KISS uses a single sound bass unit in its transmission processing area, which serves the station's three studios. Incidentally, KISS also use one of Trevor's limiters at the transmitter end to cut the peaks that might get down that far after the processing. There are, of course, other 3D systems around, including Dolby Surround, Q-Sound, the Hughes Sound Retrieval System, Roland's Sound Space, and the Ambisonics System. We looked at the various sound systems over the years, said KISS FM's Howard. The Roland system, for instance, is a lovely system, but it's very specific to recording. The main problem with the others is one of mono compatibility. Bass was the first system I saw that was suitable for the job. Soundbass's Hall reinforced this statement. One of the features which sets bass technology apart from previous and competitive binaural experiments is that the effect, once recorded onto a suitable medium, such as magnetic tape or CD, can be played back without using separate decoding devices or other specialist equipment. In fact, any domestic hi-fi will reproduce the effect. So KISS listeners with ordinary stereo systems don't have to go out and buy new equipment, even those who have portable mono radios. Any of the other 3D sound systems would have caused problems. Q-Sound is not mono compatible, even though it's been used on recordings such as Madonna's Immaculate Collection. Dolby Surround Sound, Hughes SRS, and the Ambisonic system all require additional speakers or dedicated playback equipment, and the RSS from Roland is designed specifically for use during the mixdown stage of recording. Each of the systems are also considerably more expensive than bass. Soundbase development engineer Tim Corkerton is continually improving the systems. Recent refinements to the system include fully integrated onboard PPM sum and difference level indicators, switchable balancing to plus 24 dBV, and VU metering, tailoring the unit to the needs of the broadcasting industry, explained Soundbase's Hall. Soundbase has found a market for its 3D bass system in dance music, such as that featured on Kiss FM. Artists using the system include Simply Red, The Charmin, Two for Joy, Cold Cut, Seal, Joey Beltran, and rock band Dire Straits. However, chart music is not the only area in sound production that stands to benefit from 3D enhancement. Well, I wonder what happens to the mono compatibility and so on when you play a record that's already been 3D sound based through a radio station that again adds the sound based processing. That'd be an interesting one to listen to. Continuing with the article, the bass system works equally well on opera and orchestral projects. And they mention the involvement with Star Trek and The Little Mermaid. Television broadcasting is also in line to use the technology. In Germany, bass systems are being tested by Hamburg's cable TV station Premier, as well as Classic Radio, OK Radio and Radio Hamburg. Britain's Channel 4 is also planning to evaluate a system. Senior sound supervisor David Langwidge explained that bass could be used for the station's opera series, as operas recorded around the world often have a flat, uninteresting stereo sound. I think a device like that will not only liven up the sound, but could provide a matching feel throughout the series, he said. It could improve our drama series as well. That's something about the 3D sound bass system currently being used at Kiss FM in London. And listening to that on and off, I must say, I'm mainly listening in my car in stereo, and the impression it seems to have to me is to squash the stereo sound very much to the left and right, and leaving a bit of a hole in the middle. But mind you, my car stereo is none too good anyway. But all these stereo effects seem to be coming tightly out of the left or the right speaker, and I can't hear any of this swirling stuff they're going on about. Anyway, it's an interesting system, one to watch for the future. You're listening to Sparks from Radio Facts. It's our weekly look at technology, science, and media news.
Lily white skin, glistened restless as the reed between his Philips DC-777 car radio is a must for all serious shortwave listeners who spend time in the car. The Philips DC-777 packs a sophisticated shortwave tuner, AM-FM tuner and cassette player and powerful stereo amplifier into a standard size car radio unit. AM, FM and shortwave coverage from 3170 to 21910 continuous. The stereo cassette deck is also auto-reverse. Check out the review in the World Radio and TV Handbook, and it received 4 stars in the Radio Netherlands receiver shopping list. This top-of-the-range Philips car combination is available to Radiofax listeners at the special price of £249. Contact the Radiofax sales office by telephone in the UK on 0483 275 997, or write for the brochure at Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, GU67BG in England.
Here's a letter from Mr. H.E. Greenacre in Darley Abbey in Derby. I enjoyed your broadcast yesterday. My sets are a 36-year-old Murphy with FM, long wave, medium wave and short wave using a 60-foot inverted L antenna, direction east to west, and a Roberts R727 bedside set with FM, long wave, medium wave and short wave from 3.2 to 18 megahertz. Thanks for the letter, Mr. Greenacre. And from Long Benton in Newcastle upon Tyne, Jimmy Conway writes, I've enjoyed your programmes and I intend to listen regularly. Good luck with Mr. Lloyd and the DTI. I hope you're authorised soon. He's listening on a realistic DX360 and reports reception to be very good and says Sparks is an excellent programme. That's a letter from Jimmy Conway. You can hear Radiofax, incidentally, on 3910, 6205 and 12255. And if you'd like to write into us, your comments are always welcome. The address, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. And to get a reply, which includes a station card with technical information and an artist's impression of the transmitter site, please send 50 pence, 3 international reply coupons and $1. One or the other, that is. The address again, Sparks, Radiofax, The Forge, Cranley, England, GU67BG. Now some news from the United States. Next October, NASA will begin the most comprehensive search ever conducted for evidence of intelligent life elsewhere in the universe. The search for extraterrestrial intelligence, the SETI search, Microwave Observing Project, is a ground-based 10-year effort to detect microwave radio transmissions that may have been broadcast deliberately or inadvertently towards Earth by other civilizations. The SETI project will use a combination of state-of-the-art receivers in a systematic long-range observing program. In the first few minutes of the project, more searching will be accomplished than in the combined total of all previous searches, according to Dr. John Billingham, SETI office chief at NASA's Ames Research Center. The project consists of 2 parts, a targeted search and a sky survey. The targeted search will use several of the world's largest radio telescopes to search the frequency range from 1,000 to 3,000 megahertz, seeking a variety of patterns that may indicate the presence of an artificially generated signal. This part of the search will perform the most sensitive exploration ever conducted of stars similar to our Sun that are less than 80 light-years distant. In a complementary search, the Sky Survey will use 34-meter antennas at NASA's Deep Space Network sites to cover the frequency range from 1,000 to 10,000 megahertz. Because of the greater sky area and frequencies to be covered, a signal will have to be stronger to be detected by the Sky Survey. However, this element of the project is important because it could detect signals emitted in distant regions from directions that would be overlooked by the targeted search. That report by Gerald Green in Microwave Journal. And news of what happened at the recent WARC conference. an agreement that defines how the radio spectrum will be used into the 21st century was reached earlier this month by delegates to the World Administrative Radio Conference. After a month of tough negotiations, the 1,424 delegates from 124 nations concluded the agreement in a session that lasted all night and ended at 7:30 in the morning on the final day of the conference. The conference was a success because it has done exactly what it's been asked to do, said the Secretary General of the International Telecommunications Union. This Walk 92 has been the biggest, most important, and the most difficult. What made the conference difficult was finding spaces in the spectrum for new services and technologies, particularly in the crowded 1 to 3 GHz region, and at the same time maintaining existing services. In the key area of future mobile telephone services, the conference reached a compromise between proposals for satellite-based systems and for terrestrial systems. The United States backed satellites, Europe backed what were called Future Land Mobile Public Telephone Systems, or FLMPTS. The delegates agreed to extend the primary allocation of frequencies to mobile satellite services around the 1.5 GHz frequency, providing adequate space for systems such as Motorola's Iridium, which will use the LEO satellite systems. The decisions made mean it could be possible for LEO satellite systems and the FLMPTS to be compatible, using a mixture of land and satellite links to offer a telephone system that can cover large regions cost-effectively. It will make it possible for many of the developing countries to have their own telephone communications system and other services which are currently too costly for them if they want to provide an extensive telephone coverage, said the chairman of the conference. The walk delegates also resolved to provide poor countries with financial and technical assistance to help them install systems. The conference also agreed on two frequency bands, 17.3 and 17.8 GHz in the Americas and 21.4 to 22 GHz in the rest of the world, for satellite-based high-definition television, which would be introduced from April 1997. Services can be introduced earlier, provided they do not interfere with existing services. The choice of the two bands was unfortunate, Bell Chambers said, but a single frequency band could be decided at a future conference. One possibility discussed was to replan existing broadcasting bands in the 11 to 14 GHz satellite band. One area where European delegates failed to get their proposals approved was in satellite audio broadcasting for DAB. The conference decided to place this service around the 1.5 GHz frequency, with a primary allocation worldwide. Although a primary allocation for audio broadcasting satellite services was approved, the development of DAB is not clear-cut. Several European countries are looking to introduce DAB services in the next 3 years, using a frequency in the existing VHF terrestrial broadcasting spectrum. Nevertheless, the conference decided to conduct further studies on the implementation of DAB. A further obstacle to potential international DAB service is the significant number of countries that have indicated they will allocate spectrum for BSS audio transmissions in other frequencies around 2.3 and 2.6 GHz. The conference also agreed to allocate two frequency bands around 1.6 and 1.8 GHz for public communication with commercial aircraft passengers. However, Canada, Mexico, Argentina, and the United States decided to offer these services in frequencies below 900 meg. That means aircraft will need two types of equipment to provide a worldwide telephone service. Ironically, the first area where agreement was reached was shortwave broadcasting, where previous conferences had less to deal with and had failed to agree. Walk 92 decided to extend the shortwave broadcasting bands by 790 kHz on a worldwide basis. Services wishing to use the new frequencies will also have to adopt single sideband techniques, the delegates decided. These techniques reduce the amount of bandwidth needed for transmission, so more channels can be squeezed into the spectrum, and the transmitters require less power to provide the same coverage. Delegates also decided to consider at their next conference the use of single sideband techniques in all shortwave broadcasting frequencies. An earlier conference set 2015 as the year for introducing the technique, but the delegates this year decided they would like the introduction to come before that. Well, in previous months we've run articles which show that the use of single sideband for broadcasting is far from ideal. Aside from the fact that most of you and I don't want to go out and have to buy a new radio. Anyway, that's a look at the WARC conference just finished in Spain, and that report was in Electronics World News. Seen the British war films where the British, or the Allies, behind enemy lines send secret coded messages back to headquarters. Nowadays one would think this sort of messaging a thing of the past, but Hull laboratory technician Simon Mason has not only recorded coded message broadcasts, he's had a book published about them. It was about 20 years ago when Simon first became interested in shortwave radio, listening to various other countries' broadcasts. "It's been a big hobby of mine since then," said Simon. "The shortwave band is divided up into frequencies for different groups to use. About 90% of the band is used by utility stations. These include broadcasts from shipping, aircraft, and weather stations. The broadcasting stations such as Radio Moscow use up some more, and radio hams are allocated a smaller portion of the band. It was in 1985, after reading hundreds of magazines and books on the subject, and listening for many hours, that Simon realized some of the broadcasts he kept hearing just didn't fit into any of the categories, and were quite mysterious.
6, 1, 3, 2, 9, 7, 1, 3, 2, 9, 7, 6, 0, 3, 1, 8.
I started recording these broadcasts in a file, says Simon. They were in many different languages, the main ones being English, French, Russian, Romanian, Czech, Serbo-Croat, and German, and some were in Morse code. I kept a record of the frequency, and they broadcast on times and dates when I'd heard them, for how long, and what the message actually was, if I could understand it. Most of the messages were series of numbers, that is, someone simply speaking single-digit numbers over the radio for a certain time, then stopping the broadcast. They ranged in time from 5 minutes up to 50 minutes. Obviously, these messages were in code, and the only person who would be able to understand them would be the person they were meant for, who could decode them. Now, 6 years on, Simon has published a book on these messages called Secret Signals, The Euro Numbers Mystery. I noticed that in many radio magazines, people wrote in asking the editors if they knew what these broadcasts were, says Simon. On the whole, they didn't know. So when I saw an ad from an American publishing company, which specialise in radio publications, I wrote off explaining all the information I had gathered. They thought it was worth publishing, so... This, for example, is the Lincolnshire Poacher, a target for Warble Jammers, an English language five-figure station. It began comparatively recently, that's the end of June 1989, and has kept the same format from the beginning. On the hour, the woman repeats the five-figure header three times, then repeats it five times. The interval signal is then sent five times, and then there's 10 minutes of preamble, after which two musical notes are sent three times. Simon goes on to describe the frequencies, and the woman has a distinct British accent. As noted before, the transmissions are always jammed by warble jammers, which are extremely powerful and effective, and have followed the station around during its frequency changes. And it can be currently heard on these five frequencies: 14487, 15682, 7887, 8464 and 9251. Well, radio stations reading out numbers may not seem the most exciting subject in the world, but Simon's book brings it to life, trying to unravel the mystery around the stations and using mistakes in transmissions as clues. He describes the styles of the stations lucidly, from the amateurish and stilted to the slick, with descriptions of the theme tunes, many folk songs, and the jammers used against them, such as the Woo Woo Machine, and the one that sounds like a room full of diesel engines.
Seven face to seven category awesome.
this, we can only suppose, is one of the warble jammers in some kind of trouble. The ending of the Cold War appears to have hardly affected the quantity of number transmissions. What unknown agencies still find it necessary to transmit numbers over the air? I personally heard my first number station a few months ago in the 48 meter band at about 2 a.m. and I found the experience very eerie, making me want to learn more. Secret signals provide some answers, but unveils just as many questions. Comprehensive index of frequencies and schedules is included in Secret Signals to start you off listening. As to what the stations are, well, I'll leave the last word to the authoritative BBC World Service DX programme, Waveguide. They reported one to be reading out snowfall figures for the ski slopes in Andorra. How silly of us to think that they were spy stations. Well, Secret Signals, the Euro Numbers Mystery, can be obtained by writing to TR Publications, P.O. Box 493, Lake Geneva, Wisconsin 53147 in the USA. The price is $9.95 plus £2 shipping and handling in America, or $3 for shipping and handling out of the country. And the phone number, because they take Visa and MasterCard, is 414 inside the United States, 248-4845. Alternatively, you can buy a copy direct from the author, Simon Mason, 26 Bloomfield Avenue, Hull, HU55NH. And he would like £6, including postage and packing. That's Simon Mason, 26 Bloomfield Avenue, Hull, HU55NH. £6 all in for a copy of the fascinating book Secret Signals, the Euro Numbers Mystery.
And living by numbers, I guess.
This week on Sparks, we look at Soundbase 3D, the latest surround sound gimmickry in use at KISS FM in London and in many Hollywood films to enhance Dolby Stereo, but does it work? There's a review of Secret Signals, the Euro numbers mystery. The high street banks are looking seriously at smart cards to cut down on card fraud. A look at the technology of putting a computer on a card. The outcome of the World Administrative Radio Conference. NASA's new search for extraterrestrial intelligence. How BBC Radio is shaping up to face the competition. World service on the air. And new Russian radio stations from jamming sites. A new sampling technique that can accurately synthesize a grand piano, and researchers make ICs from yeast. Well, that story coming up in a minute, but first a couple of letters. From Alan Lewis, first of all. I hear your transmissions reasonably well on 3910 at night and on 6205 during the day. I particularly enjoy the programme Sparks, with best wishes for a future UK low-power licence. My receiver is a Sony ICF7600D with a few extra metres of wire aerial. That's a letter from Alwyn Lewis in Ipswich in Suffolk. And Cyril MacDonald writes from Dijon in France. I was very much impressed by your programme Sparks. I found most, if not all, of the features highly entertaining and informative. I particularly enjoyed the report from Electronics Weekly on potential interference on the Comedy Channel broadcast from the B-Sky B satellite, from a new satellite about to begin transmissions very shortly. I also enjoyed a report on concerns over gene patenting, as American businessmen Palantir buy a British Genetic Research Centre. Another entertaining and informative report was by Barry Fox about digital cinema sound systems in the design stages at both Dolby Labs and Kodak. After hearing the report, I also wonder why Kodak still continues with its design. The Dolby system seems more practical, while Kodak's now abandoned their digital cinema system. Two more reports in the show were of particular interest. First was the report from Radio World about songs being forced to sell themselves without the need for hype. The second was the report about AM stereo in Asia-Pacific broadcasting. I'm originally from Canada, and I know there are quite a few AM stereo stations in Canada, but there are a few people who have AM stereo receivers, and those who do, and I know several, are not impressed with it. I've heard it several times, and although the sound is in stereo, the sound quality is considerably poorer than FM stereo. However, this could still be a good future for it, who knows? I plan to continue to listen to Sparks as often as possible. Well, thanks for that letter, Cyril MacDonald, who lives in Dijon in France. So, in Electronic World News, quantum structures use yeast. Researchers at the Advanced Centre for Biochemical Engineering at London's University College have come up with a novel method for producing quantum semiconductor structures using yeast, called Schizosaccharomyces pombei. Mixing the yeast with calcium sulfate, the researchers were able to produce crystalline structures 1.8 nanometers in diameter. Developed as part of a project to produce biosensors, the process can yield uniform structures, making their electrical properties more predictable. The quantum structures have already demonstrated luminous properties that don't exist in bulk cadmium sulfide, and the researchers are considering possible application, including microscopic quantum wires. Definitely been spending too much time down the pub at lunchtime, that lot. That's researchers at London's University College. And Janice Mutafis writes, from Germany, audio unit gets ovation. Electronic musical instrument vendor Wersi has introduced a synthesized grand piano whose sound integrity has brought the music world to its feet. But the audio signal sampling recreation technology used to produce the sound is likely to reverberate into applications well beyond the recording studio. What gives WRSI's digital analysis and resampling technology, that's DART, mass market appeal is that it allows the simultaneous, real-time conversion of the sampling rates of 64 signals into another set of rates. The technique also reduces by orders of magnitude the amount of information needed to generate a signal. Apart from studio technology, which is the main application, the method could be applied for material tests in quality assurance, noise analysis and signal analysis in general, said Wilfred Dittmar, electronics engineering manager at WRSI, which has filed for 2 patents on DART. Reviewers at music publications have described the sound of WRSI's synthesized piano as equal to or even slightly better than a real grand piano. But the big sound is achieved without huge data investment. WRSI reduced the amount of information necessary to generate the tone of a single key from 300 megabytes down to 3 megabytes. According to Dittmar, DART cuts the data requirement by leaving out all irrelevant and obsolete data, then creating by resampling the 300 megabytes needed for the sound. That data is stored in ROM, where it's analysed according to 8 key criteria. WRSI engineers spent the past 5 years writing analysis software to isolate characteristics out of a recorded piano sound, and then used the characteristics to resample and rebuild the original tonal qualities. One reason the technique has not been pursued actively by other companies is that ordinarily the amount of data needed to reconstruct a sound increases by a factor of 8. However, WRSI engineers found that a method similar to additive synthesis permits the partial tones that together form each piano tone to be separated and stored according to their relative volume, instead of storing a 6-second-long sample for each tone. Thus, the amount of data needed to reconstruct the sound is considerably reduced. In the DART method, each tone is broken down into 3 tonal components: a quasi-static spectrum of sinusoidal waves that represents the unique sound signature of the piano, an envelope signal containing data on the volume of the partial tones over time, and the change of the common frequency over time. The memory space used is relatively small because only the quasi-static spectrum is really stored as a sampled signal, according to WRSI's engineers. But when a key is played, the sound is synthesized simultaneously based on the information extracted from the tonal components. That's an article about a new synthesized grand piano, which reviewers claim sounds better than the real thing. Can this be true? Well, it's a new sampling system we might be hearing quite a lot more of. And you know, Sparks is the place to keep you up to date on all technical innovations and also media snippets and gossip, that sort of thing. It's on Radio Facts every Monday and Tuesday, and other Radio Facts programmes Wednesdays, which is country music, or Radio Caroline alternately. Then on Friday and Saturday, it's shows from independent people such as Jody's Rock Show and Martin D and various other producers. And on Sunday, it's Paul Bentley's Solid Gold program. And thanks to Mark Borthwick for writing in from Kelso in the Borders region of Scotland. That's Moorbattle, to be precise. He's listening with a domestic National Panasonic model, that with RF1105DLBE. His aerial is a 30-foot long wire running east to west, end-fed, clipped to receiver rod antenna, and he's amazingly listening on 12255, which is surprising considering how close he is to our transmitter site. A good shortwave station, he says, with plenty of shortwave information and good music programming. Best wishes for 1992 from Mark Bothwick.
I was hiding in the moon.
Uncharted Futures. Alistair Milne, one-time Director General of the BBC, on the competitive prospects for BBC radio networks. BBC television has had its turn of the political thumbscrew. Some sort of tranquility is now needed for programme makers and managers alike to get on with the job of making programmes. But as the charter renewal date looms closer, radio, the BBC's original heartland, is also under scrutiny. Radio is very cheap by comparison with television. The BBC radio networks produce some 35,000 hours of programmes, and that doesn't include what is made in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, nor in the 37 English local radio regions, and those networks spend less than 20% of the BBC's total budget. Radio is also now subject to intense competition. The BBC's five radio networks face competition from around 150 stations, commercial and BBC local. Yet the continuing success of the BBC networks, radios 1 and 2 commanding sizeable national audiences, radios 3 and 4 jealously protected by smaller but vocal constituencies, has frequently made them the subject of proposals for privatisation or advertising support. Mrs. Thatcher was an inveterate listener to Radio 4 in the early hours, and she recognised that no commercial channel would contemplate its kind of mix, news, current affairs, drama, women's programmes, comedy, quizzes, a vintage ragbag. She recognised, too, that commercial concerns would never consider the equivalent of Radio 3. They might undertake a classical channel, but without Radio 3's idiosyncratic additions. Her solution was for radios 1 and 2 to take advertising. They were exactly like commercial channels, she argued, not that she ever listened to them. The BBC's case, then and now, is that Radio 1 is not just another non-commercial pop channel. It commands the attention of 25% of the radio audience, with the biggest and widest reach, 6 million daily. Radio 1 can point not only to a sharp awareness of its own specialities, hiring the best DJs, constant refreshment of presentation styles, but a special character. It does things the commercial sector would never do. It has a strong commitment to the creation of new pop music, not just broadcasting recorded music, but spending some 4,500 hours of studio time in the production of music by both new and well-known groups. It offers news and current affairs geared towards the young, who would seldom listen to the more orthodox news programmes on other channels. It is notable, too, for its sequence of social action projects designed to respond to the needs of young people. These programmes give Radio 1 a particular ability to catch the interest of its already substantial audience. I think the BBC makes a good case for the special nature of Radio 1. The case for Radio 2 seems to me substantially weaker. The network's audience has been progressively eroded, largely by competition, to some extent by the loss of its medium wave frequency in the summer of 1990, when its audience had to follow it onto a new FM frequency. But its music policy of familiar and attractive melodies is the one most open to competition from the commercial stations. The BBC can justly claim to offer three channels of a distinctive nature. One with a large following, two with small but intensely loyal ones. What of Radio 5? It was frequency change that led to Radio 5's creation. Room had to be found for radio's sports coverage, for its renascent children's programmes, and educational programmes displaced by the decision not to split frequencies anymore. But the creation of yet another radio channel has undoubtedly caused confusion, and it seemed perversely expansionist at the time, even if both logical and necessary to the BBC planners. Clearly, the BBC can't cram the output of two channels into one after abandoning network splitting. But Radio 2, now the weakest distinctive link in the chain, must surely come under severe examination. The loss of sport from Radio 2 cannot have been to its advantage, and four networks look a great deal tidier than five. Two other factors need to be considered. First, what is the BBC to do, if anything, about its orchestras? They were started in its early life because, of course, there was no recorded music. Now there is plenty. The six orchestras that survived the painful musicians' strike of 1979 cost between £11 and £12 million a year. Rumours emerging from the BBC's internal studies seem once again to put the orchestra's future in the shadows. My view is that the BBC has been chiefly responsible for creating and constantly recreating an appetite for music in this country. It has already rationalised its requirements for orchestral music. The surviving orchestras are immensely important for the musical life of Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, and in England, for standards of orchestral performance and the commissioning and playing of new music. Nobody else would fund these orchestras. The BBC should therefore accept their future funding as part of its role as the leading cultural broadcaster in Europe. Should there be a news network? You would expect journalists to feel such an operation to be essential, since it is part of their trade to lap up whatever news offerings are available. Gulf FM, the rolling news operation conducted during the Gulf War on Radio 4's FM frequency, is said to have attracted a new audience and therefore to have proved a need. But all the time, has anybody established that there is a hunger for rolling news, given the great number of news outlets already existing on BBC networks? Gulf FM demonstrated that the flexibility to respond to dramatic and developing events of that kind is essential for the BBC. But to devote scarce resources and scarce frequencies to a news continuum needs better arguments than I have so far heard. If a case is made for the BBC retaining four networks, how should they be funded? The Peacock Committee, while devoting most of its efforts to examining alternative ways of funding BBC television, were quite specific about the future funding of BBC Radio. It agreed that the BBC should have the option to privatise radios 1 and 2 and local radio in whole or in part. All but Alistair Hetherington and Judith Chalmers agreed that radios 1 and 2 should be privatised and financed by advertising. 5 years on, the arguments make interesting re-reading. They recognised, with much research to rely on, that if the BBC took advertising on radio, it was likely to do so successfully, especially on its national networks, and would greatly damage ILR or any proposed commercial networks. Indeed, they saw a number of ILR stations being forced off the air. And they were writing at a time of relative national affluence, not in the depths of a recession where advertising has become increasingly hard to come by. While recognising the dangers for commercial radio and, to a lesser extent, the provincial press, they noted that it is quite possible that the introduction of advertising on one or more national radio channels would assist in bringing about the required quantum jump to bring radio advertising levels closer to those in many overseas countries. In the event the BBC did not choose to adopt Peacock's theories about advertising on radio, nor did the government seek to enforce them, but the government did index the licence fee. It then went further. It handed down licence fee settlements lower than the rate of inflation, with the express intent of squeezing the BBC harder. Peacock buried the arguments about BBC television taking advertising. The upheavals in commercial television and the painful birth process of cable and satellite can only reinforce that position. But those who advocate advertising on the popular BBC radio networks will be heard again. Will the case the BBC has traditionally advanced, that anybody who pays a licence fee deserves to have his or her tastes properly served in their fullest diversity, still seems a good one? Or will it now be regarded as time-serving? BBC Radio costs less than £2 a month, which compares very favourably with any other information or entertainment source. And if the licence fee has a future, which I think it should, then to detach parts of radio from the BBC's financial operation would not only destabilise the commercial sector, it would bring little easement to the general BBC purse. The BBC is going to have to make the case once more against partial or wholesale advertising, particularly on Radio 2, before Charter time. Those arguments will form an integral part of the general discussion about the BBC's broadcasting role after the year 2000, the cornerstone of British broadcasting still, or just another production or facility house. That was by Alistair Milne, who was Director General of the BBC between 1982 and 1987, writing in the Media Guardian.
And thanks to Patrick O'Doherty, who writes to us from Drumcolour in Charleville, County Cork. I wish to report hearing radio facts which I've monitored over the past few days. Your signal varied from frequency to frequency and from time to time, but I found 3910 After Dark to be the best. I really enjoyed Sparks, which I thought was very informative and easy to understand for the non-technical. Radio Arla I've heard several times myself. Thanks for the letter, Patrick O'Doherty, writing from County Cork.
Não soube cuidar. faz perder encontrar. Lambando estarei ao lembrar que esse amor por um dia, um instante foi
in Electronics Weekly. Banks make a smart move. High street banks are drawing up plans to introduce smart cards as part of a £500 million programme to improve the security of cash and credit cards. UK banks made a decision as early as last January to accelerate the smart card evaluation programme and set a target for introduction within 2 years. We have been told we must now come up with deliverables, said Steve Collins, manager of smart card research at Barclays Bank. Some banks are already talking with smart card suppliers, and the rest will follow by the summer. A supplier said one bank was talking about introducing its first smart cards early next year. Spiralling credit card fraud figures, which topped £165 million last year, have forced banks to brush aside their traditional reservations about the high security but high cost smart cards. The bank's first plan to combat existing card fraud is through a new Card Watch campaign, launched by the Home Secretary last week, and within 2 years they will replace the current card system. An option of building a new communications network to each terminal is thought to be too expensive. Smart cards are around 10 times the cost of current magnetic stripe cards, and to replace the UK's 80 million bank cards could cost over £200 million. But the cost of smart cards is expected to fall this year as suppliers start producing cards for the new GSM digital cellular telephone services in France and Germany. The main obstacle is converting over 200,000 retail card terminals and cash machines to read the new smart cards, but a bank spokesman said conversion costs have fallen in the last year. IC cards, commonly known as smart cards, with an 8-bit microprocessor and up to 8 kilobytes of memory, have created new card applications, from healthcare to home banking, and the banks do not want to lose out to more aggressive service providers, particularly the UK's new breed of telephone operator, who may be planning new card-based financial services. British banks have a problem. How and when should they replace their ageing magnetic card identification technology, with newer smart card systems already being introduced in France and Germany? British hole-in-the-wall banking is the cheapest to operate, and so the most widely used in Europe. But the encryption techniques are basic. 2 million credit cards were stolen in the UK last year, and criminals have little trouble in using the cards. Many feel that new government measures announced last week, which include a stolen card register and more sophisticated card usage monitoring, only paper over the cracks. The banking community now recognises that what is needed is a multi-£100 million investment in smart cards. Siemens is developing a 512-bit card code using an asymmetrical algorithm like RSA, Rivest-Shamir and Edelman code for banking applications. An 8-bit smart card can implement the GSM encryption for telephones in about 100 milliseconds, according to Paul Hill, marketing director of Auger Card Systems, but that algorithm is not secure enough for banking systems. In addition, healthcare applications will require different levels of security, so that information which can be read by a doctor cannot be read by a nurse. The main problem for the banks is that smart card systems are considerably more expensive than magnetic stripe cards. The cards for GSM services at around £5 in first production volumes are around 10 times the cost of magnetic cards. Paul Hill of Auger argues that the real cost of magnetic bank cards is closer to £10 per card if you include the cost of anti-fraud measures. The increased cost of smart card systems will inevitably be passed on to the user in return for higher security and new services. According to Reed of Motorola, the high cost is forcing banks as well as telephone operators to offer multiple application cards. This is an important aspect of work being carried on by European Telecom Standards Body ETSI. Combine a bank card with a GSM telephone card and there's a potential for home banking services. A mobile terminal which can give direct access to your bank account. A smart card-based home banking trial is already taking place in Germany and a number of UK banks are talking with telephone operators. Within 18 months, high street banks will be using smart cards, says Hill. According to Ramunaj Banjari, director of GIS, which is developing application software for smart cards supplied by Oki of Japan, the UK banks are still waiting for the right product standards, which should be finalised within a year. One thing is for certain, the UK banks have no plans to throw away their existing cards. Last year they issued over 80 million. Dual systems using both smart cards and magnetic cards will be the first stage. Many banks are now preparing their networks by buying a dual card reader from leading supplier Omron. Other European countries are taking up smart cards with a vengeance. In 1989, some 50 million smart cards were sold mainly in France and Germany, a figure which is expected to rise to 260 million in 1994. In France, no one will have a magnetic stripe card after the end of this year, says Reed. Current French systems have their limitations, and Reed anticipates that UK banks will be looking for something more. But with the cost of card fraud spiralling, they cannot afford to wait much longer. That report in Electronics Weekly.
More news of radio freedoms in Russia. Here's Vasily Stolnikov.
Yeah, any more stations on the horizon?
Okay, there's a new independent shortwave radio station going on the air. This on a frequency of 11945 kilohertz. The station is Radio Space. They use a 20 kilowatt transmitter broadcasting from a former jamming site in a place called Balashikha. That's just outside of Moscow. And reception reports are welcome, and they are verified with a QSL card.
That sounds a bit like a hobby station, isn't it? Radio Space?
Radio Space. It could be anything.
Okay, we'll see what happens. Any more?
Just part of that report about new stations broadcasting from the ex-Soviet Union. That was Vasily Stolnikov on Media Network from Radio Netherlands. The Ship to Shore service received some coverage on a play on BBC Radio 4 recently. Last Call. A trawler is heading for almost certain disaster. The crew are given the chance to say goodbye to families and loved ones. The play heavily featured Portishead Radio, that's the one near Weston-super-Mare in the Severn Estuary, which still handles the HF long-distance traffic. It's operated these days by British Telecom International. Here are the last few words before the ship sinks.
However, my damn trace is freezing. I cannot say for sure. Please advise, Portishead. Please advise.
Kingston Fury, Kingston Fury, this is Portishead. Come in, please. Kingston Fury, please respond.
In Last Call by Geraldine McCaughrean, David Calder played the skipper.
A play called Last Call on BBC Radio 4, featuring very good quality ship-to-shore communications. But the rigging and the superstructure on the trawler became so overladen with icing that the vessel was lost.